NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Good to see you guys. I'm getting ready to finally get this Piper Aero, Turbo Aero, out to Colorado. Been spending a lot of time in Georgia doing a lot of work on it, and it's almost there. And I've been doing a lot of flying. I flew a Piper Aztec and a Piper Archer. So, getting back in the swing of things since the weather's nice. You still flying, Todd?
Unfortunately, no. The last few months have been crazy for all sorts of reasons, but I'm intending to get back into flying by the middle of the summer.
And I know that John's been flapping his wings, so he's been flying a lot. So
I still tell everybody I made flying safer when I stopped flying.
Well, It is just sad to think that you gave up flying because that wing warp kind of flying is just difficult for you. Oh, well.
Well, this accident we're doing today, Greg, is just for you. Since you're going to be flying this airplane back to Denver, and it hasn't flown in a long time, and we're going to give you a good example of what not to do.
Reading this accident, one, I shake my head at the NTSB investigation, but two, I shake my head even more about all the information that came out about this pilot in the airplane. And it just, again, these stupid pilot tricks. I do not understand smart people making just ridiculously bad decisions. And it blows me away. So with that, Todd, I'll let you at least introduce the accident to begin.
Before you go, Todd, mention the pilot's experience and hours and what he has. And then, let everybody listen to what he did.
So this is a pilot, 49-year-old person. He has instructor ratings for airplane multi-engine, airplane single-engine, and instrument airplane. He's got a Class 1 medical. He is a commercial pilot, flight instructor. And, again, he's a person who has quite a few hours, 1,049 all told. But very tellingly, only 9 hours in this make and model. And many of those hours came in the last two flights he took.
And when you look at what happened, the big thing now is the fact that here you have a pilot. He's got 1,000 hours. He's got some ratings. He is a CFI. You would think just with those qualifications, one of the things about being a CFI is that not only do you have to instill good aeronautical decision-making into others, but you should probably practice what you preach. This is a case where it's one thing to tell somebody else what to do, but then not heed your own words. So with that, Todd, why don't you give us a rundown of this accident?
Well, certainly. This was a November 2021 event involving a Piper Comanche, twin Piper. This happened to be an airplane that was recently purchased by this gentleman. It had been not flying for quite some time, I believe.
10 years.
And after 10 years on the ground, this person was going to fly the aircraft back. This person had fairly minimal time in any kind of twin-engine aircraft, there's things that start piling up very, very quickly. For example, he's in a hurry to get this airplane. The logbooks weren't with the airplane when he purchased the airplane, so his first act as a pilot of this new airplane, new owner rather, was to fly to get the logbooks. And you think, why fly to get the logbooks? What is the big hurry? Reading the narrative and reading some of the public docket information, this person was in a hurry to move this airplane to a new location and start flying. To the point that he didn't have a really, really good understanding of the airplane. And just to give you an idea, he didn't know how many fuel tanks were in the aircraft, and he didn't know the main tank from the auxiliary tank. This is something he was asking both, I believe, the mechanic who had worked on the airplane. And he was getting advice also from his own CFI, who was a friend of his. And the advice he was being given, which was a fairly sensible piece of advice, is don't fly this airplane. Leave the airplane on the ground. Drive the car. There's no need to do this. For whatever reason, he didn't listen. He flew the first leg. Everything's fine. He picks up the logbooks. He's coming back on the second leg. And unfortunately, there are problems. Again, this airplane had been flying for several years, and there's no indication that there was any sort of pre-buy inspection, any kind of serious inspection by a mechanic of this aircraft. There had been some issues with this aircraft, which he found out in flight. The gear indicating light for one of the landing gear wasn't working, and he was trying to diagnose that problem in the air. Now, at this point, it sounds like a normal sort of thing. You have a problem, you're trying to diagnose it. One of the tools he was using to diagnose this, and this was an event that was happening at night, for the first day he flew this aircraft, at night, second leg, he's calling a mechanic on the telephone trying to help diagnose this problem. Now, he might say he's a single pilot in this aircraft, which, by the way, there's also deteriorating weather in the area. He's flying this airplane without a real good knowledge of the systems, and he's dividing his attention between flying the airplane, talking on the phone, and also taking a picture of, I believe it was the landing gear handle. He was taking a picture of something in the airplane trying to send it back to the ground. I don't know much about aeronautical decision-making, but this struck me as a case where the decision-making before he got on the airplane was somewhat faulty.
Well, let's step back and unpack this, because there is just so much. It starts with the fact that based on what the investigator wrote, it would appear, based on witness statements and the other information, that this pilot bought this airplane basically sight unseen. Because typically in a pre-buy inspection, of course, you're going to have a mechanic go over the aircraft, with a fine-tooth comb. And part of that pre-buy is having the maintenance records with the aircraft, because you need to know whether or not this airplane is actually airworthy, not only through inspection, but have ADs been accomplished, and have there been modifications? Are the STCs, properly signed off? Is there, what's going on? Plus the fact that this airplane has been sitting for 10 years, basically, even though somebody was supposedly doing annual inspections, an annual inspection doesn't require the airplane to fly. And so again, what was the extent of all that? The investigative report doesn't go into that kind of detail. It just says, through witness statements, that this is the history of this aircraft. So now you have a pilot who's very anxious about buying this airplane, getting into this airplane and flying this airplane somewhere, presumably to their home base. John, we've had these discussions before. You buy an airplane sight unseen. One thing is you got to understand the airplane. And the way you do that is to get every frickin' flight manual you can find and not only educate yourself on the airplane, stem to stern, especially systems, but then you go get an instructor to fly with you in this airplane so that you understand what it is you're getting yourself into. So let's start with that. What's wrong with this picture?
Where do you start? Yeah. He's putting self-imposed pressure on himself. He's got to get this airplane back. Did he do a pre-flight on it? Was he in such a hurry just to get down and get the logbooks? Did he have any other material than the logbooks? Like you said, were there other instruction manuals that came with it? Those are all questions that should have been asked and answered, but they're not in this report. Then he takes off and And on that second leg of the flight, he's got a nose gear problem, light problem, while he's on the ground. And he continues. So he doesn't even take the time when he's on the ground. And of course, you don't know, because they don't say, was there maintenance available on that field, or was there anybody that could have called? And when he did call his mechanic, he told him to take a car, leave the airplane there and take a drive home. And he said, no, he's got to get the airplane home. Again, here comes the pressure. So he had self-imposed pressure going down there, self-imposed pressure when he was there, and recognized there was a problem, but decided to keep on going. Bad decisions. There's your decision making, Todd. And then as he takes off and goes on, the problems start to multiply.
It goes beyond that. This guy had no business being in this airplane. He didn't understand the airplane, didn't know the airplane. So to John's point, we don't know what kind of pre-flight he did. It's obvious that, you know, he may have done something, but we don't know the extent of it. And given the fact that there was no pre-buy done, or at least that's an indication from the report, there's no pre-buy done, we don't know what worked and what didn't work. Now, one of the witness statements did say that they spent, you know, that this guy spent 2 hours sitting in the airplane, and a mechanic who was familiar with the airplane explained all the avionics. That doesn't, first off, I don't buy it. Second off, why would you spend 2 hours going over the avionics? I don't care how sophisticated the avionics were. The report really doesn't talk about what kind of avionics package was in there. But I want to know more about the systems and how to fly this airplane than, you know, all of the avionics. Yes, I mean, radios are radios, and you'll eventually learn how to fly it. But you got to take the time to understand the entire aircraft, not just fragments of the aircraft. Okay, there's the button. Push that button, put fuel to it, and see you later. It doesn't work that way, especially when you're flying this type of aircraft. He should have had a formal checkout. He should have been reading the flight manual or the pilot information manual, whichever was in the aircraft, to understand the systems. For him to ask a basic question, how many fuel tanks, which ones are the mains, and which ones are the aux tanks, is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of, because this guy did it basically prior to, I'm going to kick the tires, light the fire, and get out of here.
One of the things about this report is we're stating some concerns about this pilot, his decision-making, and the sequence of events. That doesn't seem to be the NTSB's focus. Their probable cause statement was, the pilot's exceedance of the airplane's critical angle of attack while troubleshooting a landing gear indication, which resulted in an aerodynamic stall at low altitude.
First off, that's so vanilla. Second off, that's such a cop-out. John, you brought up a point while we were talking before we started recording. You know, this all apparently stems from a light bulb issue in the aircraft. Now, it's apparent, you know, based on the cryptic interview notes that are in the public docket, that the pilot may have been aware of a landing gear issue on the ground before he actually departed. There's no resolution to that. He apparently made the statement to someone via a telephone call, I think to his wife or partner or whatever. The fact is that he's taking off with a known issue. He's doing all of this flying at night in a brand new airplane that he has no clue about. He's never flown, never been checked out. I don't care if you have a multi-engine rating. You don't just jump in and fire it up and say goodbye. So now he's got some complex issues. Now, in the Comanche, you know, you put the gear handle down. I had a single-engine 260 Comanche. You put the gear handle down, you know the gear is coming out of the well. One, you can feel it because it's basically right under the seat, that front seat. Two, you can hear it. Even with headphones on, headset on, you can hear it come down. You have that light. It's a single light, if I remember correctly. It's a single light. You have a transit light, and then you have down indicating that the gear is down and locked. That light apparently was burned out. According to the NTSB, the filament was fragmented, which means it was cold. If it had been hot and actually working at the time of impact, the filament would have been stretched. Okay, so you're not really sure if that gear is down or not. So now he doesn't know the systems. He doesn't know the manual extension handle. So he makes a telephone call to the mechanic and has a conversation. Meanwhile, he's motoring around at 2 or 3 miles a minute, wandering all over the sky, you know, near the airport to try and, you know, figure out this problem.
And for those of you watching the video version of this, we have a depiction of the kind of wandering that he was doing prior to the accident. And again, this is a nighttime event as well. And he's not just flying the airplane. He's also talking on the phone, looking to take a picture of things down on the floor. And I can't help but think, in a nighttime low visibility situation, that your head is moving in places that you don't usually move when you're flying an airplane. Could this lead to a slight case of vertigo? Especially the stress of a brand new, to him, aircraft.
And there's no discussion about whether or not he's using the autopilot. It's obvious that, you know, some of the altitude changes, it would indicate that he wasn't using the autopilot. He's on the phone with his wife, who made a phone call during this whole little excursion. All of these things are now distractions. He's not focused on the main issue. He's making phone calls. He's doing this. He still has to be a pilot, still has to fly, still has to maintain control. Meanwhile, he's trying to figure out whether or not the landing gear is up or down. You know, but he's flying an airplane that he has no business even being in because he just wasn't familiar. And not only did he not heed the warning once, he didn't heed the warning twice when he was told, park the airplane and drive. We'll train, we'll work on the airplane, we'll make sure it's good, and you can fly it back another day. But as you said earlier, Todd, I think it's obvious from the interview with the pilot's wife that he was all excited about this airplane, gung-ho, always wanted to have a twin Comanche, and it was hell or high water.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Hi, my name is Marcy Veroni, and I'm in charge of training the underwriters that work here at Avemco. We have a Redbird simulator that we use in our training. It's a 172S model. Our local flight school also has 172s, so we hope that the non-pilots get the interest to go and then become pilots. But regardless, everybody that work here goes through ground school, either Sporties or King, and then we actually put them in the sim. We hire local CFIs to come in and take them through different scenarios. Then we take them to the airport. They've all watched an engine being torn down. They've all pre-flighted an airplane. Most of them have gone for a flight in an airplane. But the reason why I really like the sim is when there is a claim somewhere around the country, we're able to bring our team in here and fly the scenario and kind of teach them the mindset of the pilot and might have, you know, what went wrong. Or is there anything from our point of view that we can help with the next caller that maybe wants to buy that airplane or do the scenario? So
when you're talking to an Avemco underwriter, you're getting somebody who really understands aviation. Even if they don't have a pilot certificate, they do understand aviation. You can tell them your story, you can give them your information, and they can do a fair and appropriate evaluation to issue you insurance.
And now, back to the Flight Safety Detectives.
When I preach aviation safety in my safety presentations and that kind of thing, I'm always talking about, and I think both of you brought it up, the self-induced pressure. The self-induced pressure was, I got to accomplish the mission. I want to get this airplane home to my home base. Doesn't matter if the engines are on fire and stuff, I'm going to keep going. I mean, that's the way this report is written with all the information that resides in the docket. The fact that he said that, yeah, he was concerned there was some weather moving in, but he was going to continue to fly. He's flying an unfamiliar airplane at night with systems that he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the fuel system, let alone the landing gear system. And now all of these distractions, and like you said, Todd, you know, he's head bobbing. Why? Because the emergency extension handle and the fuel selector valves are down between the seats. So now he's down. He's still having to fly the airplane. We don't know if he's on an autopilot. Apparently he isn't. And if you look at the ADS-B data on him, it's obvious that he got down into the low 60s. That airplane's coming out of the sky in the low 60s. That is down. So, okay, the airplane stalled. But for a probable cause statement to just say the pilot exceeded the critical angle of attack and stalled the airplane, that's the best you can come up with? When you've written a diatribe of information, excerpted a lot of information about gear speeds and a variety of other things in the report, and the public docket has all of this other information that would be useful for pilots to learn lessons in a timeline, in a sequence of events, and the best you come up with is the pilot exceeded the critical angle and stalled the airplane? I mean, we've talked about loss of control. I just did my flight instructor refresher. There's a two-hour section about LOC, loss of control, and the causes of it and why and how to prevent it. And the best you can come up with is this guy stalled the airplane and crashed. What about all the other stuff that led to him stalling the airplane and crashing? That's the learning lesson. That's the stuff that should be spotlighted in a probable cause and contributing factors, not the end result. It's obvious that he stalled the airplane and crashed. Okay, great. But how did he get there? Why did he get there? You know, that's the problem. And John, you and I, we have these conversations all the time, and the frustration between the three of us, you know, that, I mean, if you just take the analysis section of the NTSB's report and the probable cause, you learn nothing from this really probably textbook case accident. You go into the docket and you see all this stuff. You even go into parts of the report, you see all this stuff. Yet it's not reflected in the analysis or the probable cause. So what do you learn from it?
It sounds like they put this together. They did a fair amount of work on the front end, and then it sat around, and then it was, oh, my God, we got to get this out. And they just did the easy button, as you say, the big red easy button, and kicked it out the door. If they had done that analysis and put it in, it would have been a very meaningful report for training purposes for other pilots.
But yeah, well,
it's a wasted effort.
I'm adding this to my repertoire of accidents that I'm going to use as case studies because it doesn't get any better than this. I mean, there are just so many things that went wrong, you know, to build this huge sequence of events. It's all lost unless you pull the entire report like we did and get into the public docket to read all the good stuff that never surfaces. It never sees the light of day in the accident report.
This is a good one, Greg, for Oshkosh.
And I intend to use it, absolutely. Because, again, you know, it's sad that we had a loss of life, but we have got to learn lessons from these types of accidents. You can't just write this off that the pilot failed to maintain control, lost control, failed to, you know, keep the airplane flying because he exceeded the critical angle of attack and stalled the airplane. So what? Tell me why. Tell me how. And tell me basically how we're going to prevent this from happening again.
Now, reading through this and discussing this, and there are several people involved, not just the pilot, who were in contact with the pilot at one point or another. Is there anything they reasonably could have done beyond what they did do?
I think so. I mean, friends don't let friends fly. I mean, apparently, based on what is in the docket and the information in the interview with this pilot's CFI friend, why would you condone his action of, you know, sitting there with him, supposedly getting a briefing on all this avionics, and then thinking that this guy was qualified and competent to fly this airplane for the first time by himself? You know, I would have taken the keys away and said, you're not going anywhere. I don't care if you're a friend of mine or not. You're not going because you're going to hurt yourself in this airplane, especially given the fact that you're going to depart at night and do all these things. Come on, really? Not happening. And, you know, it's easy to sit here and say that, but if they were really, truly friends, And you have a CFI who is evaluating your friend who just bought a new airplane that he has zero experience in. And you're going to let him fly away at night without ever being checked out or without that airplane ever having a pre-buy or really knowing whether or not it's actually airworthy or not. Man, that is just a prescription for disaster.
Imagine 10 years of annuals with the airplane not flying.
Yes.
I'm just beside myself with that one.
Yes. And yeah. you got a flight instructor and you have a mechanic who are just condoning. Yep, here are the keys. Give us your money. See you later. It just, I don't understand that rationale. That decision making. It's just, it's beside me. And we lost a good airplane and we lost a human. And, you know, that's the sad part of it. I mean, the airplane that I'm buying, I mean, you see it behind me. That airplane sat for 8 years. But I've been through that airplane now for the fourth or fifth time with one of our other colleagues, Jason, who is a very accomplished AMP mechanic and IA. We've gone through that airplane multiple times. I've had to replace a lot of critical parts. But I know that when I'm ready to take that airplane into the air, it's going to be solid. It's going to be airworthy. And the only thing that could hurt me is me.
Let me ask you this about Jason. Did he point out anything to you about this airplane that you totally missed?
No, because we have initially been through this airplane with the mindset that the airplane has been sitting for so long that we cannot overlook or just brush off even the smallest of hangar rash. Because, again, those little things that you just, you know, we found a problem on the bottom of the right wing that wasn't there 5 years ago when we first looked at the airplane. And the question is, how did it get there? Because we hadn't moved the airplane in and out of the hangar much. That was disconcerting. It's not an airworthiness issue, but it's those little things. And the more we worked on it, the more things we found needed to be fixed or replaced. And I have no problem replacing things rather than just say, I'll wait till it fails. I don't need failure in any way, shape, or form. I don't need problems. We had a burned out or at least a loose light on our landing gear in this airplane. I switched the light bulbs around, and it was obvious that, you know, it was a connection. It works now, and it has been working because we've done a gear swing on the airplane. But it's still going to be something that I'm going to monitor. So, I mean, it is the little things, and that's why you have to do a very thorough pre-buy, especially on an airplane, John. You know, I mean, if you walked in and somebody said, John, let's go fly this airplane, and you start asking the first question, when was the last time it flew? 10 years ago. Would you get in it?
Well, I said this on a show just a short time ago, that I was in Los Angeles going flying with somebody and walked out to the airplane, and it happened to be very, very windy. He wanted to go flying. I said, no, I'm not going to go flying. And I said, oh, by the way, fix those 7 rivets that are loose on the airplane, because I could see them. I mean, you look at your airplane. You don't have to own it. You look at it. You're going to fly in it. You look at it.
Yeah. Well, I flew with a very accomplished friend of mine over the weekend. He has a number of airplanes, but we flew a Piper Aztec, and I haven't flown an Aztec in forever, but he is a very accomplished pilot, and we had a discussion like we're having right now about pilots and just walking up to do a pre-flight. He said, you know, the most important part of the pre-flight is walking up to the airplane, and I just started laughing because I could hear John in my head. Because Jim said the same thing. He said, the most important part is as you walk up to the airplane, does it look normal? Is it cockeyed on the ramp? Is the strut, you know, are they equal? I mean, does it look like one wing is higher than the other? Because you could have it misfueled. You could have a variety of things. Do things look like they should? That's the first observation of a pre-flight. And then you get into the nitnoid stuff. But I just couldn't help but laugh because he brought that up. He goes, yep, I walk up to the airplane. I'm looking for things that don't look right, you know? And when I watched people, especially young people that are learning how to fly at the airport that I'm at, they just walk up, you know, and do their thing. They're not looking at the airplane. All they're doing is looking towards the airplane to see where they're going as far as the door they're going to get in to start the pre-flight. You know, it's the little things. It's just like, how many of us walk around our car to make sure all four tires are inflated before you drive away? 99.9% of the people don't. I do. I walk at various angles when I go to the car, so I know that all four tires are inflated before I pull out of the parking space or drive it away. It's, you don't know. I mean, you're driving down the road, tire was partially flat. Next thing you know, it goes flat on the highways you're getting on. And then you got people that are running over you at 60 miles an hour. So right. It's just, this is a textbook case. And I know, Todd, you're going to post this up. But I would implore our viewers and our listeners to actually go through this one when you have time and pull all the information down from the docket, or we'll post it up so you have a link. But go through and you know, look at it from an investigative eye. Read the witness statements. Read the information that's in the docket. And read, of course, the report. And think about, you know, all of these things. This accident started on the ground. It didn't happen in the air. It started on the ground. It culminated, you know, when there was a loss of control. But the accident sequence started well before this pilot ever got airborne. And these are the frustrating things from an investigative and safety standpoint. How do we get this point across? How do you curb that behavior? Especially somebody who supposedly has, you know, quote, experience of 1,000 hours and is a CFI. I mean, I can imagine if that's his attitude and that's the way he thinks, what's he been teaching students if he's been flying with students? Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. Let's just go. Don't worry about, oh, that's just a light. Don't worry about it. You don't need to know about that. You don't need to know about that system. The fuel system, as long as you got gas, you're good. If that's the attitude, we're all in for trouble. It's just crazy. So with that ranting, Todd, I will leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, my second to last word is a bit of an inside knowledge as to why we're talking about this. I actually came across this months ago when I was researching a completely different kind of accident, and it caught my eye. I didn't even read the public docket, just a couple of paragraphs of the main report. It's like, there's some good stuff here. One of these days, we're going to have to sit down and talk about this, and this is one of those days. So for those of you out there who are looking for learning examples, either for your class or for yourself, I can't recommend more than go to the NTSB, find a report that looks good, and go to that public docket. Because if the report is looking interesting, usually that public docket has many things that'll be interesting to go along with that report.
And with that, John, I'm going to leave you with our last word.
And this is going to be painful to do. All right. If you're going to go flying, prepare for it. Don't do what this gentleman did. Do a good session at home, pre-planning your whole flight. When you get to the airport, do it again. When you get out to the airplane, as we just said, look at your airplane, touch your airplane, you know, wiggle your flight controls on this particular airplane. You could pick up a bearing easily. I just told somebody just a couple of days ago, he's saying, what should I look for? Well, one of the things you look for, almost all general aviation airplanes have their hinges exposed. You can look down on them on your airplane. Look for rust stains because water gets into those sealed bearings and those bearings can rust. So you want to look for the rust stains. All right. Wiggle your airplane all over. You can hear if something's rattling, something's banging. All right. When you get in the airplane, do a good cockpit check. And when you get in the air, put that head on a swivel because you don't want to get involved with anybody else's mishap. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Avemco Insurance Company has thousands of 5-star reviews on Trustpilot.com. Here's one from Henry K., who said, "For more than 18 years, Avemco has insured me and my aircraft. The cost has been very reasonable and the service excellent. Completely satisfied. The only claim I ever had was handled quickly and to my complete satisfaction. Avemco is a first-rate insurer." Experience the advantage going direct with Avemco Insurance Company. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.